From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida represent. A bunch of Sunshine State folks are coming aboard the incoming Trump administration.
A chief diplomat who understands how important that is to Florida's economy. That's just as important as the political sort of messaging he brings.
Also this week, but there are those in Florida who fear the new administration's tough talk on immigration.
They are scared if they deported them, who's going to be with the children here?
We'll also learn about the chances for Florida lawmakers to hold a special session before March's regular session. And we'll find out how cold weather affects the state's iconic manatees. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. President-elect Donald Trump's swearing-in will take place this month. In preparation, he's filled influential positions in his cabinet with several Florida Republicans. Tristan Wood reports political watchers believe that's a positive for residents here in the Sunshine State.
Floridians have been tapped to be Trump's chief of staff, attorney general, secretary of state, national security advisor, and Center for Disease Control head. For Republican Party of Florida Chair Evan Power, that's a sign of his party's political dominance.
Florida has really become the conservative beacon of freedom, and we have a lot of talented individuals who've governed, and we've had a lot of big wins here in Florida, so it makes a lot of sense that President Trump's going to elevate those people who've had success on a conservative level, and you see them going to the national level to fix the country like they fixed Florida.
The state's government has been at the center of national headlines in recent years for championing culture war legislation, like banning transgender athletes from sports and targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Steve Shale, a Florida Democrat political consultant who worked for the Obama administration, doesn't buy that the country is going to become like Florida because of those appointments. However, he does believe those appointments are good for Floridians because it means the people who have Trump's ear will understand issues important to Florida.
Folks tend to bring the perspective of where they come from when they go to Washington. And so, you know, just understanding what issues are important to Florida, understanding the kind of the vibe of things, understanding what the challenges are.
To Susan McManus, political science professor emeritus from the University of South Florida, one of those issues will be health care. Florida's older and still aging population means more investment in medical infrastructure is needed in the state. She hopes those from Florida in Trump's administration will communicate those needs.
Florida has a very large portion of our economy now that is medically focused, whether it's the production of medical equipment and technology to the universities and the hospital systems doing pathbreaking research. And of course, the public themselves complaining about the insurance part of the health care.
One of the most prominent Trump appointments from Florida is Senator Marco Rubio, who is tapped for the Secretary of State job. A child of Cuban expats, he has been a staunch anti-communist in Congress. Shale believes for Florida, Rubio's place in the administration means far more than politics. He argues Rubio will be a strong international business advocate for many industries in Florida that rely on relationships with South American countries.
So having a chief diplomat who understands how important that is to Florida's economy, that's just as important as the political sort of messaging he brings. You know, if you're a Miami business and, you know, and that relationship with Brazil is important, you know, having a Secretary of State, you know, ambassador who gets that, is really important.
But Rubio's influence on the administration's political messaging could still be impactful in growing his party's lead in Florida and other states. McManus believes Rubio and other South Florida Republicans' rhetoric about anti-communism targeted to Cuban and Venezuelan expats and their children is part of the reason Miami-Dade voted Republican in 2024.
Florida's been very good at understanding you cannot take broad categories of voters like, let's take Latinos or Asians or women and say that they are cohesive and monolithic in their voting pattern. So Florida Republicans have been very adept at micro-targeting with a better understanding of the diversity within these broad groups. And those are also lessons that can be shared with Republicans elsewhere.
Whether it's the members of Trump's administration or the trips the president-elect is likely to take to Mar-a-Lago, Get ready to hear a lot more about Florida in the national media over the next 4 years. I'm Tristan Wood.
President-elect Donald Trump's promise of mass deportations is creating stress and fear for the 5% of Floridians who are undocumented immigrants and for their families. Amid the uncertainty, some are taking steps to protect their loved ones and property, as we hear from Joe Burns.
No matter the politics, the threat of deportation is real for many people here.
It's definitely on the top of our list when it comes to a conversation at the dinner table.
That's 23-year-old Salvador Rosas, who works with youth at Hope Community Center in Apopka. He and his two younger brothers were born here, but his parents are undocumented immigrants from Mexico.
Basically, we're trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen next. We have that huge fear of maybe it could end up causing separation between the family. What's going to end up happening to my parents? What ends up happening to my youngest sibling?
Their family is one of about 4 million mixed status families in America, according to the American Immigration Council. And in Florida, 250,000 underaged U.S. citizens live with an undocumented parent. Rosas says the families he's spoken with fall into two buckets. There are those who are afraid of what's going to happen and are thinking about returning to their home countries.
The second bucket would be, you know what, we're going to stay put. I think the best thing for us to do is stay here. We've been doing this for 15 plus years.
They say politicians come and go, but their situation doesn't seem to change much. Rosas says his folks are in that second bucket. But even before President Trump takes office, his election has made them more afraid to travel out of state. His parents scrapped a trip to Chicago and won't be celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary with family there. For Rosas, the risk of separation hit home after his mother's decision not to travel to see her own mom.
And it made me think, my mom was just a child at that moment, just trying to see her mom again. And it gives me that same feeling if it was to happen to me.
Angela Eisenman leads the nonprofit Mexican Coalition of Florida and helps women in crisis at the Mexican consulate in Orlando.
The people is scared for many things. The people is scared because first, the most important for them is the children. They are scared if they deport them, who going to be with the children here?
She wants to help them be informed, not fearful, and connected with trustworthy legal help.
The people already have traumas. They have already stories that they bring. That is why this is very sad. We don't want to put them more stressed. We don't want to put them more scared.
At Hope Community Center, Executive Director Felipe Sosa Lazabelez sees a difficult holiday season for many of the people they serve.
A lot of folks are coming to Christmas dinner thinking, is this the last dinner that we're ever going to have together? And honestly, that's just heart-wrenching.
His immigration department will be training more staff and volunteers to help undocumented immigrants prepare.
So we work with them on creating a plan for their children, creating a plan for their finances, creating a plan for different aspects of their lives, including making sure that they have a power of attorney for someone else that they trust.
What if a mom is arrested at work or detained on the road, for instance? She'll need someone approved to pick up the kids from school and to help make sure they're not lost in the system.
We call it a dignity plan because we think it's about taking control of your own life. But we also know it's really hard, okay? It's not only complicated and difficult to think through, it's actually emotionally challenging.
He'll have people with training and a checklist in hand to walk with them. In Apopka, I'm Joe Burns.
Coming up on Capitol Report, Governor DeSantis would like state lawmakers to make a quick trip to Tallahassee before the regular 2025 session starts in March to tackle what he considers some critical issues.
We have agreement. I'll call the session and we'll go. But I do think we need to act sooner rather than later.
A possible and risky solution to Florida's property insurance crisis? Just don't have any insurance at all.
Insurance is nothing but a game. So I just said, fine, I'm not going to have insurance.
A renowned Florida jurist retires and leaves a lasting legacy.
Nobody was responsible for the system that was allowing these poor people to cycle in and out of every possible acute system in our community at great expense and at great harm to these poor individuals.
and we'll get up close to some wintering manatees. We just won't get too close. Governor Ron DeSantis is hoping Florida lawmakers will get the ball rolling to address the state's looming condominium crisis. The governor wants to see a special session, but Adrian Andrews tells us legislative leaders disagree.
Recently, DeSantis made a stop in Tampa for the swearing-in of Hillsborough County's newly appointed state attorney, Susie Lopez. While there, the governor answered questions about the future of the condo industry in Florida, telling reporters that millions of Floridians may be on the verge of losing their homes due to high costs.
Things happen in life, and it's not like the government can save, but this was created by legislation.
The governor says lawmakers are partially to blame for the rising cost of insurance and homeowners association fees. He says prices started going up after he signed off on new laws approved by the legislature following the deadly Surfside condo collapse in 2021. 98 people were killed in the incident, and DeSantis says the legislature wanted these laws to prevent similar tragedies.
I think everyone had to acknowledge it was kind of a work in progress. There was no way there weren't going to be issues.
At the time, there was bipartisan agreement on rules that required high-rise condo buildings to be inspected and for funding to be set aside for repairs and maintenance. To the governor's point, those laws did create problems for some condo owners.
My unit's 1,400 square feet. My assessment's $49,000.
Earl Cooper purchased his parents' condo in Tampa. The building is over 40 years old, and Florida's law requires that the property's HOA fully fund its reserves to get the building up to code. But that requires residents like Cooper to pay more in assessment fees and, in most cases, higher property insurance.
Smallest apartment, which is like 1,200, 1,300 square feet, the assessment is in the high $30,000. It goes up from there. We have one unit, which is a larger unit. Their assessment's $100,000.
Governor DeSantis says he wanted lawmakers to convene months ago, but couldn't get the House or the Senate to agree.
I don't know that there's an agreement on exactly what needs to happen, because I said, look, if we have agreement, I'll call the session and we'll go. But I do think we need to act sooner rather than later.
Florida's newly elected House Speaker, Danny Perez, says he thinks it's best to have the conversation during the regular session, which starts in March.
When people call for a special session, they're very quick to pull the trigger on saying special session. But we should think about what is the topic and the solutions that we're trying to solve for.
I'm Adrian Andrews.
The number of Florida homeowners foregoing property insurance coverage is at an all-time high. One in five homeowners are not insured at all. It comes at a risk, but with Florida having the most expensive premiums in the country, Lillian Hernandez-Caraballo explains why some homeowners are opting out.
Last year's hurricane season is behind us, but as we know, Floridians are never quite in the clear. Rain pours and thunderclaps on this December afternoon in Brevard County. But longtime Malvern resident David Schroeder Sr. isn't concerned, even though his house is uninsured.
There's never been any damage done to it.
Schroeder's home was built in the 50s and sits just off U.S. Highway 1, about a quarter mile west of the Indian River. He inherited the house after his mother died about 40 years ago and has owned it outright ever since. Without a mortgage lender to require insurance on the property, it's entirely up to Schroeder whether he wants coverage or not. The 74-year-old says ever-growing premiums drained his budget for years before he opted out.
Went from 200 to 300, then to 600, then to 800 a year, and it kept going up.
Schroeder says companies kept raising prices and doing less. The whole ordeal was frustrating him.
And I said, you know, since the house has been built, there's never been a claim. And think of all that money that has been wasted. Insurance is nothing but a game. So I just said, fine, I'm not going to have insurance.
Schroeder canceled his last insurance policy back in 2010 and says he's never looked back. He's not alone.
Right now, 20% of homeowners in Florida have opted to self-insure and remain uninsured.
Divya Sangham is an insurance expert with Value Penguin, a research site that analyzed Florida's insurance crisis.
This is extremely risky, but a huge part of this is in response to their very limited and very expensive options for homeowners insurance.
As extreme weather events drive up insurance claims and payouts, private insurers have gone out of business. After Hurricane Ian in 2022, Florida lost more than 30 insurance companies. The ones that remained hiked up premiums and minimized risks, closing nearly a third of Ian's claims without payment and dropping millions of policies in the process. Filling in the gap is state-run Citizens Property Insurance Corporation, which peaked at 1.4 million policies in 2023 and also hiked up prices and denied more than half its claims that year.
So when you take all of this in context, you're going to end up with a lot of homeowners thinking, I'm not paying for home insurance. Nothing has ever happened to my house. I'm just going to take the risk until they fix the insurance problem in the state.
Mark Friedlander is with the Industry Association Insurance Information Institute and says Florida lawmakers have passed major insurance reforms in the last 2 years to help fix the market. He says it's working.
The industry is in a very strong financial position, the best in more than a decade. We expect stability to continue in 2025.
Florida welcomed at least 8 new private insurers last year. Friedlander says this gives homeowners more options and hopefully keeps them from joining the self-insuring trend.
We have seen so many homeowners in the past few years, they decided to self-insure to save and to the point where they cannot rebuild their homes and they have to move. It's a bad road to go down. In most cases, if you make that decision, you're going to regret it for the rest of your life.
Back in Melbourne, Schroeder says it's an easy decision, but he's aware of the risk.
Well, it's a chance, like I said, and I'm gambling, but life is a chance anyway. I could walk out this door and get hit by a car right in the middle of the street. Lightning could hit my house any minute, but you have to have faith and trust, and I know that I am blessed.
In Orlando, I'm Lillian Hernandez-Caravaggio.
Miami-Dade County Judge Steve Lightman has just stepped down from the bench after 30 years, effective December 31st. He's internationally known for developing major reforms of how the criminal justice system deals with people who have mental illnesses. He's even been honored by Pope Francis. Margie Menzel reports.
Lightman says his career has coincided exactly with the deinstitutionalization of people with mental illnesses 48 years ago. At that time, most people with mental illnesses were in institutional care, such as in a psychiatric hospital. And Lightman was a 17-year-old legislative intern sent to look into a constituent's complaint about the way her son was being treated in institutional care.
And I find Jonathan, and he is in a bed in all four-point restraints. And he's probably 100, 150 pounds overweight from the Thorazine that they are injecting him with. And he's screaming and carrying on and crying and moaning out of a horror movie. And it was way before HIPAA. So I asked to see his files, like I knew what I was looking at or for. So I'm going through this stuff and I'm trying to figure out what the hell it meant. I had no idea, except something caught my eye. And I talked to the staff and I said, excuse me, what's this? It says that he's autistic. He wasn't even psychotic. He was autistic.
Jonathan ended up getting proper treatment, says Lifeman. But when the institutional care facilities began releasing people into the community for services, the criminal justice system wasn't ready for it.
Everyone realized we had a problem. Everyone realized it was wrong. It wasn't political. It wasn't D or R, or law enforcement versus PD. It wasn't like that at all. It was great. It's just that what we recognize is that we were all so busy doing our job, judges judging, prosecutors prosecuting, defenders defending, police policing. Nobody was responsible for the system that was allowing these poor people to cycle in and out of every possible acute system in our community at great expense and at great harm to these poor individuals.
The Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project found that, on average, people with mental illnesses remain incarcerated 4 to 8 times longer than people without mental illnesses arrested for the exact same charge, at a cost 7 times higher. In 2000, Lifeman helped develop a training program that teaches law enforcement officers to recognize the signs and symptoms of mental illnesses. That's the pre-arrest piece of the Criminal Mental Health Project.
We set up a treatment program for our police here because they don't, for all the obvious reasons, they do not want to go to get treatment at their departments. You know, the stigma, losing their jobs, promotion, all of that good stuff. You know, last year, more police died from suicide than in the line of duty. It's terrible. And so the woman that runs my CIT program, that's our police crisis intervention team police program, she gets 150 to 250 calls a month from police officers for their own personal mental health issues. And so we set up a treatment program where we'll get them treated outside their department with the permission of all the police chiefs. And we don't have to report it unless they're suicidal or homicidal. And so they love it. And it has played a significant role. You can see, you can draw like a straight line down from the 5 years before we started CIT to now, where the police shootings have just almost stopped. It's really remarkable. And, you know, that was something we had not even anticipated. That was just a wonderful ancillary benefit of doing the right thing for the right reason. Then it turns out it saved the city of Miami hundreds of millions of dollars.
The post-arrest piece of the project diverts people with mental illnesses to treatment centers rather than locking them up.
And part two is we set up a post-arrest diversion program. So if you get arrested now, we have a whole new screening system. And if you meet criteria for our program and you're willing to take treatment, we get you out of jail and we get you into a full treatment system. And if you meet criteria for the Baker Act on a misdemeanor, we usually get you out within a few days of your arrest. We try not to order as many psychological evaluations because they're a waste of time, but instead try to get you treated. And if you successfully complete our program, which most do, we drop the charges anyway and you don't have a record.
With this in place, Lifeman says, recidivism for Miami-Dade's misdemeanor population went from 75% to 20%, and recidivism among its felony population went from 75% to 6%. And now, with the administrative responsibilities of a judge behind him, Lifeman is free to devote himself to taking his reforms to other states and other nations. I'm Margie Menzel.
With a major grower set to exit the business, Florida's struggling citrus industry saw little change today in a production forecast for the hurricane-damaged growing season. The updated outlook from the U.S. Department of Agriculture keeps anticipated orange and grapefruit yields in Florida where they were a month ago when the first post-Hurricane Milton numbers were released. Overall, the industry is facing a harvest that's nearly 20% lower than what was projected prior to Milton's impact in mid-October. Florida Citrus Mutual CEO Matt Joyner said that today's numbers may be a positive for the rest of the season.
We're thrilled to see that we're holding steady and hopeful that means we're going to get through the rest of the season and be as productive as we can post such an impact like what we saw in Milton.
The updated outlook follows Fort Myers-based Alico Incorporated announcing earlier this week it was getting out of the citrus business once the current crop is harvested. Alico's action is estimated to remove about 12% of the remaining acreage used in Florida for citrus. The current forecast would be the lowest output for the industry since the 1918-1919 growing season. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, forecasters say much of Florida is in for some cold temperatures this weekend. And cold temperatures in Florida can have a serious impact on the animals living in the Sunshine State. When the temps dip too low, cold stunning can impact creatures, from the iguanas that fall from South Florida trees to the sea turtles on the coast and manatees making their way into the warmer rivers and springs. Regan McCarthy took a trip to Wakulla Springs in North Florida, where a pod of manatees was gathered to wait out the cold.
It's early in the morning at Wakulla Springs State Park in North Florida. The birds are just waking up. It's barely 35 degrees, cold enough that steam appears to rise off the water. In the summer, the First Magnitude Spring is a popular swimming spot. As the sun bakes the shore, the water, which is a constant 68 degrees no matter the season, offers cool relief. But today, the relative warmth of that unchanging temperature is what draws a pod of manatees. And those manatees are what have drawn visitors to the top of a two-story observation deck.
There's two big ones laying right here under.
They're also what's drawn Emily Leckis and Kennedy McGrath to the state park today.
I'm suiting up in my wetsuit to go snorkel with some manatees.
That's Leckis. And if you're wondering whether she's prepared for that chilly plunge, don't worry. She's done it before.
Yes, we were out here yesterday morning. It was great. There were dozens of manatees, but it's pretty cold.
Leckis is from Jacksonville, but she says she's been coming to Wakulla Springs for years. This time she brought McGrath, a Missouri native, along.
She told me about this place and I was like, oh, I've never swam with a manatee before, so that would be a good bucket list item.
Wow.
We both study marine biology, so we're like always doing fun ocean things together.
Leckis and McGrath say they know the rules. They'll keep a respectful distance and be sure not to disturb the gentle sea cows. That's important, says Michelle Passowitz, Manatee Management Program Coordinator with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission.
If an animal is spooked or disrupted or feels that they don't have an adequate place to rest at a warm water site, they might leave, and that can expose them to cold water temperatures for prolonged periods of time, which can be lethal.
Too much exposure to cold water can cause a manatee to become cold stressed. They may appear lethargic, be unable to swim normally, or even feed themselves. In some cases, cold stress can lead to death. That's why Passowitz says anyone observing manatees should mind their manatee manners.
There isn't an actual distance per se, but the golden rule is that if an animal responds to your presence or your activity, then you are too close. So watching from a distance, whether that be on a kayak or a paddleboard or even snorkeling in the water, you don't want to get too close where that animal can feel your presence or that you might potentially separate a mother and calf.
In recent years, manatee deaths have been a concern. 2021 set the record with more than 1,000 deaths recorded, many of which were attributed to starvation. More recently, those numbers have decreased.
Right now, things are looking pretty good. 2024, we had 565 carcasses, which is actually very low compared to our five-year average, and that's great news. A lot of those cases were due to watercraft collusion or red tide or other cases not associated with starvation or cold stress even.
In the past, wildlife officials have operated a limited feeding program in certain areas. But Passowitz says there's enough food naturally available now and the feeding program is no longer needed. But she adds her team is carefully monitoring the animals, especially during this chilly weather. She says anyone who sees a manatee in distress should call the state's wildlife hotline. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Joe Burns and Lillian Hernandez-Caraballo. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.